Hello, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thanks. I'm so excited to be here. This is amazing.
So I'm very curious about you. The first person who sort of put you on my radar was Bizarro. I know you guys have been talking a bunch. And when Bizarro first sort of introduced the concept of you, and the concept of you, in my opinion, you can correct me, is that here is this person with two Shakespeare arts degrees and like their master's degrees, right?
Yeah. Yep.
That's a lot of time. That's a lot of time. What are they specifically, those master's degrees?
So my first master's degree is a Master of Letters, and then the second master's degree is a Master of Fine Arts, with the idea that I can, and you'll forgive the expression, but it's the idea that I can basically take Shakespeare from page to stage. So I can teach it like textually, I know a lot about how it's on the page, and then also I know a lot about acting good.
Acting real good.
And acting real good. Grammars. It's fine.
Great. And then about 2 years ago, my understanding is you started getting interested in magic.
Yeah. So it's really funny because I was trying to figure out if I should tell this story or not, but I feel like this is a story that you might appreciate. So I have this very specific memory. I've always loved magic. I always thought magic was fascinating and super interesting, but I have this very specific memory of being like 7 or 8 years old, and I decided that I was going to be a magician. And so I went to the library and I got a book about magic, and I was like, yeah, magic book, let's go. And I do not remember what the magic book was, but I remember that very specifically in the magic book, they talked all about how to hide stuff like in your cummerbund and in your jacket pocket and in your tuxedo. And I was a very literal little kid. Like, I was very literal, and I took things like very seriously. And in my head, this was a book of magic rules, and this was like how magic was supposed to be. And so as a girl who didn't wear tuxedos, I remember having this like very specific reaction of looking through the book, like reading all the tricks and everything, and going, oh, well, I can't do magic because I'm not a boy and I don't wear tuxedos. And so then I just like put it away, and I just didn't do magic for a really long time. And then just weirdly in grad school, we were doing a production of Midsummer Night's Dream, and I got cast as Puck, which was bananas. And the director had this concept that the sort of lover's chase that happens in the show would be this like full scale, large, like stage magic, like people appearing and disappearing. And like Puck was going to be sort of like at the center of all of that. And so I got this like super quick and dirty introduction to stage magic. And that was really, really cool and just so much fun. And then a little bit later on, another magician who was actually working for me at the Renaissance Festival where I work now, basically came into my office and was like, look at this coin matrix. And I was so fascinated, and I got so mad and frustrated because I couldn't figure out how he did it. And then basically he just challenged me to figure it out. And so then I read every magic book I could find because I'm a nerd. And now I do magic. That's the story.
That's a great story. So how long ago was that moment? The like coin matrix, this is my time moment.
That was like the start. That was about 2 years ago. That was when I started really honestly realizing how much other magic stuff was out there. It just wasn't on my radar for so long. And then almost, it was so funny, like in a week, I went from having read, you know, one book when I was like 7 to having read like 15. And I was like obsessed with it. And I was like, yes, this is so interesting and so fascinating. And I think part of it was just the academics of it, the history of it. And that's something that honestly really excites me. It's just like the traditions and, you know, this person took this person's idea and turned it into their idea. And then this person took that idea. And so it's been so cool, like just from like a, you know, Shakespeare nerd historical standpoint, to read through and like see those sort of changes. And I think that's just so interesting.
Yeah, it really is. And I'm kind of in that headspace right now, too, because I'm working on my book and I want to talk about, I don't know if you've heard my metamodernity talk, but just the idea of like eras of magic and what they represent. And here's part of why I was so curious about you when Biz started talking about you, because in my mind, I think of Shakespeare and traditional theater as this highbrow, fancy, well-respected, but then also like easily dismissed art form in the same way that visual art is, which is where I come from. And then magic is this like hyper accessible lowbrow thing. Now that's pretty common, is that when things are inaccessible, we tend to imagine them to be more fancy. And when things are very accessible, we imagine them to be less fancy. Like you can see high fashion is like that, you know, jeans are very accessible, so they must not be that fancy. But like weird, crazy high structured 3D fiber cities level fashion design is inaccessible, so therefore that's the fancy kind, even though those kind of perceptions tend to not actually relate. So I'm really curious about this idea of like, here's this person who, you know, you have so much interest in this area that is about deciphering language in a way, and it's about old-timey language, and it's its own way of speaking and way of communicating. And then here's magic, which is also its own form of communication, but I feel like, and maybe this is just my perception, those could not be on more different ends of the spectrum.
Oh, did you just open the soapbox? And that's something that I love about teaching Shakespeare. Like, that's a big part of what I do, is I do a lot of like going into schools and lecturing and that kind of thing. And that really is kind of the conception of Shakespeare. And I don't want to say that it's a misconception, because Shakespeare is heightened. It is heightened language. It is the ideas of heightened emotions, heightened circumstances, right? But honestly, the way that I like to put it the most is that the thing about Shakespeare is that there was a point in time where nobody knew the end of Romeo and Juliet. There was a point where people walked into the theater and they came out shocked and surprised and moved and excited about what they had just seen. And because Shakespeare has become so ingrained in the culture, we forget that there was a point where these ideas were new, and we forget that there was this point where he was literally changing the way theater was constructed and written and performed. And honestly, even more than that, Shakespeare was always for the people. You know, the vast audiences in London, they were common folks. You know, there were royals and there were rich folk who came to the theater, but for the most part, the people who were coming to the London stages were common folk. And so Shakespeare was for the people. Like, it's, you know, 98% dick jokes with some fancy poetry smattered in on top for the fancy people in the back. And so because of that, because of this idea that Shakespeare was for the people and it was accessible, and it, I like to think it still is, but because of those ideas, like, those were things that I honestly saw more parallels between Shakespeare and magic than not, if that makes sense. And I think what is really cool about magic and fascinating and interesting about magic is that as performers, as magicians, as people who do magic, you have the opportunity to say, I'm going to take this old story, I'm going to take this idea, this trick, and I'm going to present it in a new and exciting way. I'm going to put my own stamp on it. And that's like exactly what Shakespeare was doing. He was taking these traditional stories, he was taking these, you know, Romeo and Juliet is not a new idea. It was old even when Shakespeare was doing it, right? But taking that and putting your own sort of spin on it, like, that's just what Shakespeare did, man. Like, he was just here to party.
That's so great. That's really great. So, I find there are pieces of my education that I use all the time in magic. What pieces of your education do you find you're constantly referencing in your creation of magic?
Oh my gosh, that's such a good question. I think for me, my sort of brand, my sort of way that I approach magic is about structured storytelling, which is maybe not the best way of putting it. But the thing with Shakespeare is, you know, there was like a traditional sort of five-act structure that he followed in pretty much all of his plays. And I think that having sort of this fundamental understanding of storytelling and what makes a good story and how to tell a good story, like, where do you put the peaks, where do you put the valleys, where do you put the boring speeches about history or whatever, right? Like, you know, where do you put all of those component elements together into your show to make it something cohesive, to make it something important, and to honestly make it something that people care about from start to finish, right? And I keep going back to Romeo and Juliet, but I think it's like a really perfect example, because Romeo and Juliet starts out with a guy coming out on stage and telling you the entire plot of the show. He says, here's what's going to happen in the play. Let's go, right? But the interesting thing about Romeo and Juliet, and not a lot of people know this, so this is a fun free fact, is that Romeo and Juliet is structured like a comedy until it's not. And that sort of idea, right, because there were all these different versions of Romeo and Juliet that existed before, right? But Shakespeare looked at those and said, well, we know what the ending's going to be. And so what Shakespeare did is Shakespeare took that and said, well, what if I made it so maybe it will work out? Maybe the audience thinks that it's going to work out at the end. And so the first like three acts are structured like a comedy and they follow the same plot points, they follow the same beats. And then all of a sudden Mercutio dies and it's like, oh no, what is happening? Like my structure has been subverted. And I think that's a really cool thing to do in magic, to subvert expectations, to say, hey, you're at a magic show, but like, you know, there's going to be music or there's going to be something else. There's going to be like moments of surprise and moments that subvert your expectation in a way that really contribute to the whole overall. Yes, that is my answer.
Okay. So, and mostly where you work is Renaissance fairs, yes?
Yeah. So my fancy big kid job is I am the entertainment director of the Georgia Renaissance Festival. Everything the light touches except turkey legs, beer, and taking care of the grounds, I'm in charge of. And so that is my day job. But then in terms of performing, I host the pub crawl at the Renaissance Festival, but I don't actually like do magic there. The cool thing about my job is that it's basically full time from like, well, now this year is really weird, but usually it's like January through June, my job is full time. And then I only have to be in the office like 2 days a week, June through January, if that makes sense. So I have all of this time to sort of do shows and go on tours and do Shakespeare and act and perform and all of this stuff. So that is where I actually spend the bulk of my performance time, is not actually at the Renaissance Festival.
Okay. So and that's when you do your magic.
Yes.
And so what venues do you normally perform?
So, like, weirdly all over. So basically, I've performed in a lot of different venues because when I first started out, I was kind of doing my own thing. And so I picked up, like, a lot of little gigs, a lot of street magic, did a lot of, like, look at my card trick on the corner type stuff. And then I got together with a performance partner and we put together a show called Nevermore, which was sort of like a Halloween-based sort of spooky magic show. And we performed that in a lot of different places. We did a lot of conventions. We did a lot of like smaller theaters, that kind of thing. Yeah. And so now I'm kind of like doing my own thing right now. And so I'm kind of working to actually develop like a show that is really in line with kind of those ideas I have about storytelling and that sort of thing. But yeah, just all over, I guess. Not a very interesting answer. I've done magic places. Good answer.
I'm curious about that answer specifically because in my experience, and it could just be the kind of performer I am, there are venues that are more interested in a show that is more theatrical and has a lot of storytelling elements. And then there are performances I do where you kind of need to come out and do a lot of magic and they're there to see magic and they're less patient about storytelling. For example, a Chicago Magic Lounge, that's a very theater-going audience and they want highbrow theater. They want high concept. You know, my indulgence show was perfect there. But then if I tried to do that in more of an arena show, people get a little impatient with some of the audience participation bits. They want a lot more, as you would say, Shakespearean style dick jokes. They want a lot of like highbrow dick jokes, which is basically my brand. And they want a lot of magic and they want a lot of visual stuff and they want it happening right away. And so I've learned to really cater my performance to each venue. And I know that you and I have sort of a similar sort of literary aesthetic when it comes to our writing. I think we write in kind of the same way, even if we perform differently. Have you found the same thing where some of your storytelling tactics are more welcome in places than others? And in certain environments, you realize like, oh no, I just have to do 30 card tricks.
Yeah, it's actually really funny that you said that because I've been really struggling with that because the thing that I want to do is very, the sort of like vision and the thing that I'm really passionate about and I get excited about doing is very sort of theatrical, high concept. I don't want to say like fourth wall because like there's audience participation and that kind of thing, but it's much more grounded in my background, which is like found space theater, right? And like that was kind of where I got my start, was doing Shakespeare in like a furniture warehouse and an art museum and like that kind of thing, and like adapting to the space. And so it's so funny because I have these sort of grand ideas for these fancy shows, but a lot of times, you know, especially the, I hesitate to say it, but like the work that pays is, well, can you just come do some card tricks? You know, can you just come read some minds or whatever? And I'm like, yeah, sure. But like, I have this cool 4-act Christmas Carol whiskey tasting show. Would you like that? And they're like, nah, just come read some poems, you know? And so it's just like, it's so interesting having to both sort of stay true to yourself as an artist, but then also really try and meet those demands and honor the wishes of the client and give them what they're looking for. And it's sometimes it's just diametrically opposed.
How do you identify which clients are going to be the ones where you can perform the version of the show that you're most proud of, and which clients are the ones where, or the venues specifically, where you have to just do the card tricks and kind of be a bit of a move monkey?
I feel silly saying this, but I just ask, which is maybe like very silly, but one of my like weird side hustles is I own a murder mystery company, and so I've gotten very used to talking with venues and venue reps and saying, okay, so here's the structure of this show, right? Here's what we normally do. Is that right for you? If it's not, I can change it. You know, I have the ability to adapt. We can change it. We can do all this different stuff. But I think for me, and at least the way that I tend to approach it, is I just try to be very honest, and I try to be very communicative in approaching venues and in, you know, keeping those things open. Also, just really cheesy stuff. Like, I watch videos of other performers who have performed on YouTube and see like, okay, well, you know, like, Carissa brought this beautiful show to the Chicago Magic Theater. Okay, I could probably bring my like full show there, right? You know, whereas like I don't think it would play as well at Steve's Wine Bar or something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's really smart to kind of do your research on your own time. And this is the age of technology. There is so much information out there about what other performers have been where and what they've gotten away with. So one of the other things I want to talk to you about is I feel like perhaps you are one of the most interesting people in this new realm of magic that we're having. I'm running into lots and lots of women that are coming into magic right now that have a similar narrative that you do, which is they were interested in magic as a child, they were put off for some reason, and now they're in their late 20s, early 30s, mid 30s, early 40s, and they're coming back to magic. There's just something that's happened in the culture of magic that has sort of opened up the doors. And we do have like young women coming into magic, but it's interesting because I'm really noticing we have a lot of people who are in your situation where they've been doing magic 2, maybe 3 years. They just got here, but they have been interested their whole life. And this is just for the first time they have felt welcome somehow. And that's not my experience. So I'm really interested in hearing you speak to that experience. And, you know, yeah, you speak specifically about this one coin trick and you were like, finally, it's time. But what there's there something about the landscape of magic that made you feel more welcome? Or was there something about like being able to see more women on stage, or even like the language around magic has changed, or just the language around culture in general, the Me Too movement? You know, what was it that made you feel like you belonged here again?
Oh, man. I feel like my answer is going to be very controversial.
Yes!
But honestly, I don't think it has anything to do with magic. I think it has to do with the fact that somewhere around age 25, I was in the middle of getting my master's, and I had this very cheesy, melodramatic existential crisis. And I realized that I was facing basically two paths. And the one path that I could take was to sort of, I don't want to say conform, but to sort of like work to fit in the traditional sort of narrative of, you know, what I felt society was sort of telling me that I should be and do. Or, conversely, on the other side, I could continue sort of this path that I'd already sort of been tentatively walking down, which was a path of like, you know what? I want to become a blacksmith for 2 years. So then I did, right? And so, and the more that I looked at those two sort of facets, I realized that every time I had said yes to the thing that I was passionate about, every time I said yes to the thing that was maybe like a little weird, a little outside of the norm, but that was the thing that got me to the next place, that took me to the next creative outlet, or like inspired me to do the next thing. And I kind of just had this moment where I was like, why am I working so hard to not authentically be myself? Which is, you know, again, it's very silly to say. But I think like once I had that moment, once I had that opportunity, then I was like, you know what? It's cool if I want to read 100 books on mentalism. Like, what is the harm in that? And then I got interested enough to start exploring it and brave enough to start performing and reaching out and making connections and that kind of thing. And it's not always been a good experience. There's been some, quite frankly, horrible experiences. But the thing that I found was being authentically myself and honoring that part of me. I wind up on a podcast that I've listened to for 2 years and I'm a super fan of, and I'm talking to Krissa Hendricks and I'm trying not to freak out because, like, that's where that got me. And so, you know, Eric Tate is a buddy of mine, and it was so funny. I was teasing him because he sent me his lecture notes and I was reading them, and like Eric Tate's lecture notes were the first time in my entire life that I saw female pronouns in a magic book. Now, it is entirely possible that I miss them, you know, but it's like that kind of thing where it's like, I just want to keep doing my own thing. And I feel like people see that and they recognize that. And I don't know, that was maybe a terrible answer. I'm sorry.
No, I think that's a great answer. There is a lot of literature early on in magic that talks about how magic is inherently masculine and it's not going to appeal to women. And that was the biggest hurdle we had to overcome in the first place. And so I think it's great that your authentic self was interested in magic and you just went, you know what? Get out of my way. Elbow, elbow, elbow. I'm going to do this. And I don't get out of my way. One of the other things I want to ask you, we're kind of wrapping up, but as the entertainment director of a Renaissance festival, you do a lot of entertainment booking. And I think that's a really lovely place to be as a performer. I was in that position as the entertainment director for the Alberta College of Art and Design, and also as the as an agent for my small entertainment firm in Western Canada. I learned a lot about mistakes that performers make in trying to get booked, and then I was able to apply those to my career. And I think that was one of the best learning experiences, is performers being annoying at me all the time taught me what is annoying for bookers, or what is unappealing, or what makes people feel uncomfortable. What are the things that you've picked up as an entertainment director that you have used to get booked, like things that you wouldn't do or things that you make sure to do?
Oh man, I feel like that's going to be my book that I write. It's just going to be about that. Just here's what's not to do. I mean, there's so many, and some of it is like really silly stuff. Like the number of people who I email and I say, hello, I would like to give you a job. And then they don't answer my email for 6 months. Or God, there's so many. There's so many. But I think if I could sort of like summarize it, it would be knowing who you are, knowing what you do, and being able to succinctly and specifically illustrate that in a way that is marketable. So things like having marketing stuff, you know, designing marketing that is cohesive to your brand, having a video, she said, having no videos of her new show yet. hypocritically, you know, things like that.
It's a new show.
It's a
you
new
get
show.
Time.
It's fine. We're gonna get there. And you know, but other things too that weirdly I took for granted, like don't talk shit about the organization that you're trying to book with on the internet, like in the middle of the process. Like the number of people who do that is weirdly high, and I'm like, I see this. And I think also just my like wish, if I had like one wish, is to recognize that the person on the other end of the phone or the other end of the email is a person, you know, and just recognizing that, like, you don't need to email 60 times. Email them once. They will get back to you. If they don't get back to you, there's probably a good reason for that. Like, a pandemic's on. I'm busy. Like, you know, it's just so funny to me, like, how things like brand and image and marketing materials are things that really slip through the cracks. And they're the things that I pay the most attention to, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Is there one like big thing that you have found performers do that immediately you stop booking them? Like other than talking smack on the internet, I know for me there are a few things that performers do. Like my biggest thing is performers that I'm as an agent, I'm at the point in the process where I'm just looking for availability and they immediately call me 3 times to ask for 1,000 details. And you know, you need to know that there are phases of bookings. I will have this information and I will voluntarily give it to you without you asking for it. If I haven't volunteered it, it's because I don't have it.
It's so real. Honestly, my thing, and this is something that I've started taking a harder stance on than I did earlier in my job, even like after booking, right? To me, it comes down to how you treat people on stage and how you treat people backstage, which is such a huge thing. And to me, I feel like there are so many incredible, wonderful performers out there. And if I go to your show and you are mean to your audience volunteers, or you don't respect them, or you don't take the time to acknowledge them, that to me speaks volumes about who you are as a performer, even more than like, you know, yeah, calling me 17 times is like, please don't. But I'm willing to put up with that if you're like a really good entertainer. But just there's so many people who perform and they're just rude and mean. And it's like, I try really hard not to be judgy about it, but it's like, I'm so excited to perform. I don't understand people who take it for granted and are mean, if that makes sense.
I think the amount of people taking performing for granted is going to drop dramatically for a little while after the pandemic. Because you're just going to go, oh, remember that thing that I did that I loved that I thought of as work because I forgot how lucky I am? Ah, okay.
Yes.
Let's maybe.
One maybe hopes. Not for a while. One hopes.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see. There's no promises. No promises. No. Those are all really, really valuable. I think you're in a really interesting position as a person who books entertainment and is trying to get booked for entertainment, because you see things that people do and you go, oh man, I totally do that and I'm going to stop doing that.
Yeah, it's honestly been really educational and I'm really grateful too, you know, because it's like I did have a lot of like bad habits as a performer, like when I was first starting out, you know, and it was like, oh gosh, like now I look back, I'm like, oh, that was so cringy. I can't believe I did that, you know, and but it's nice too because I think it also, in the way that I cringe at my own sort of like, oh gosh, I can't believe I did that. Also, like, it's really nice when I get an email from somebody who's obviously just starting out on the circuit and this is their first email that they've ever sent and it's just terrible, because then you get the opportunity to be like, hey, I've been where you are. I perform. I understand what it's like. Here's a couple of tips, you know? And so, like, it's cool that I get to do that as well, because I just feel like artists supporting artists is like a really, really important thing. And I would rather send the awkward email that's like, hey, you have 9 spelling errors and your website link doesn't work, than just be like, delete, you know, because it's like, like, why not give that person a chance? You know, like, I don't know. That's like my weird thing about being where I am, I guess.
That feels weirdly pointed at me, because I had like 2 spelling errors on my front page of my website up until like 2 weeks ago.
Oh my gosh.
Nobody said anything. Yeah, I was in the editing and I went, oh, that's a typo. And then I went scroll down and went, oh, that's another typo.
I hate it.
How many people read this?
Oh my gosh. That's part of my problem too, is because like I'm so like academic and like just my brain is so like Ravenclaw that like I'll go through people's websites and be like, should I tell them? Should I not tell them? And then I feel like awkward about it. And then I like spell stuff wrong on my own. I spelled Shakespeare wrong in my master's thesis twice. Like not smooth.
No. That's worth a couple of points. And it's crazy that you and I are talking today, because today is a very special day, isn't it?
It's Shakespeare's birthday. It's the day of my people. yeah, it's, you know, it's a holiday of sorts. Yeah.
I'm very grateful that you were able to make time to talk to me today, because I'm sure that you have like a ton of stuff to do today.
Oh my gosh. It's a really fun day. I love it because I get to spend, thanks to Zoom, I've been able to like talk to like a lot of kids and stuff. So it's been like a really fun day for me. So yeah, but I'm like, I'm so happy. This has been amazing.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad. And I really want to thank you so much for being on the podcast. If people are more interested in hearing any of Katie's experiences or relationships with magic, she did a wonderful lecture for the IBM. It was available online on their Facebook page for 24 hours, but it is still available behind the membership wall of the IBM. So if you do not have your membership renewed, it is only $60. You can email them or go to their website to renew your membership. I know I had to. And go on there and check it out. Also, Harrison Lampert has done a really wonderful lecture recently. Kayla did a lecture for them, and I also did a lecture, as well as Bizarro and tons of other people that we've had on the podcast before. Basically, I feel a little bit like the IBM is going through our back catalog of speakers and people we've interviewed and having them do lectures. But you know what? I'm fine with that. We're happy to be trendsetters. Thank you very much for joining us today on this very special episode of Shazam. And remember, it's Shakespeare's birthday.
Happy birthday, Shakespeare!
How old would he be today?
Oh, man. I can't even figure out time zones. Don't ask me math questions.
End scene. Great. See? Majestic.
Shazam is sponsored in part by the Society of American Magicians. Thank you, SAM. Go join a club.
Yay! Who's excited about Shakespeare? Nobody, because I'm sitting in my closet. Like, it's just so weird.